From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the alien hunter, Daryl Sims, joins me. Looking forward to that. And by the way, effective immediately, we are eliminating the 30-day call rule. As you know, that's kind of a very old, antiquated rule where only people were allowed to call once every 30 days. This program, folks, has gotten so big. Sometimes it takes people 2 years to get in. Other times people know the system. They know how to leak through. But we are eliminating, effective immediately, that 30-day call rule. If you get in, you get in. It's fate, isn't it? Here's what's happening. Sony hackers apparently demand the studio pull the interview. It's a movie. The group calling itself GOP has warned Sony to stop immediately showing the movie of terrorism, which can break the regional peace, they say, and cause war. GOP stands for Guardians of Peace, whoever they may be. They did not specifically identify the movie. Authorities have been investigating, though, whether the hacker attack is in some way connected to that movie, The Interview. The movie has generated condemnation from the government of North Korea because it talks a lot about Kim Jong-un. It kind of like shows him. One in three items of clothing, furniture, household appliances bought in Britain are now purchased online, according to new analysis. And I'm sure it's the same thing here in the United States and Canada. For the first time, families are using the Internet for more than 30% of the main shopping that they do outside of groceries brought in by supermarkets and convenience stores as well. Investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, 30%, that is huge, isn't it?
Okay, so, George, I'm a huge skeptic. If you look at the statistics that the Commerce Department released in the after the first quarter of this year, for all shopping, it was about 6%. For discretionary, about 13%. But here's where I think the numbers really get interesting. What's really happening is it's melting. There's a meltdown between the physical and the online. So I'm going to the store, but I'm using my mobile phone to comparison price and to get information about the product. And so it's not either or, it's and. So I think if you look at the statistics here, you know, that's what takes you up to these higher percentages. So,
But you're unique, Catherine. You're very unique.
Pardon me?
You're unique. You're a unique shopper. I mean, you study, you investigate. A lot of people, you know, are just passion shoppers, and I think bricks and mortar stores are in trouble.
Well, that's not what I'm seeing. You know, I live in a rural area which tends to do a lot of shopping. I think if bricks and mortar are in trouble, and they're certainly shrinking and taking the competition, but where they're going to be in trouble, George, is when online figures out essential. So when I left San Francisco this year, there was an announcement that the post office was going to prototype delivering your groceries to your door early in the morning, sort of overnight.
Right.
Now, you know, if the post office gets into the act and we see drones delivering groceries, et cetera, that's when they're really going to start to cut into the. So I don't disagree that it's coming, but in fact, it's been a little bit slower than I expected. And the reality is, I think, whether you're digital or physical, you're going to need to be good at both. To be really competitive in this market, you're going to have to be good at both.
We will talk with you before Christmas, for sure.
Okay.
Catherine Austin Fitz, her website, Solari.com. Bricks and mortar stores, a lot of them are in trouble. JCPenney, Sears, some of the Best Buy stores have closed over the last few years. The Internet and digital, it has done an amazing job of capturing the attention of shoppers who simply say, look, you know, I don't want to have to go park my car and all that hassle of people. I'll just sit back, order it, and have it delivered. A recent Korean Airlines flight was delayed when its chairman's daughter, who was also the vice president responsible for cabin service at the airline, ordered a senior crew member off the plane. What did he do? Allowing her and other passengers in the end of the aircraft to be served bag macadamia nuts instead of nuts on a plate. The executive resigned amid a storm of public criticism in South Korea The airline had earlier accused her behavior, even as it apologized for inconveniencing passengers. Jeez. A Russian astrophysicist says his team has located a huge mountain-sized asteroid whose orbit crosses Earth's path every 3 years. Now, even though the experts say the giant object known as 2014 UR116 poses no immediate threat of collision, its unexpected discovery underscores how little is known about asteroids and their unpredictable orbits. Let's check in with Steve Cates, Dr. Sky, on this one. Steve, I've been saying for years that we can't track all these asteroids, and look at this story.
Absolutely, George, and we have some good news. The Canadian satellite known as NEOS is about a suitcase-sized spacecraft. Its sole purpose is to track these objects. That's the good news. But a little bit of quick intel on this particular story. As you reported, Russian space scientists have discovered 2014 UR116, which is about 1,300 feet in diameter, allegedly. But the good news, according to astronomers now at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they're saying, get a load of this, this is good news for Earth. This object will only pass some 2.7 million miles close to us. Here's a date, in April of 2047. But on the other side, George, which you talked about at the beginning of this little interview, there's now some 1,523 of these potentially hazardous asteroids, something that we need to pay attention to, of course. And for the local sky event, George, this relates so much to the topic we're talking about. Folks, if you're out with clear skies now, peaking this Saturday into Sunday, the Geminid meteor shower, George, is radiating and really burning up some great debris, 78,000 miles per hour. These are some bright fireballs that people can see all throughout the coast audience. Look into the northeast sky. You can see now high up, almost nearly overhead in some parts of the country. But, George, the activity starts picking up big time towards Saturday, maybe with skies that are clear, upwards of 50 of these meteors per hour. And, George, I want to say Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to this audience. But particularly, I want to thank you and your producer, Tom, and the staff for having me a part of the beautiful Holiday Magic Coast-style CD that I'm sure you've been talking about, and hope that all the listeners got a copy. Thank you so much for having me a part of that.
Thank you, Steve, and it was great. You know, I first got to know Steve Cates when executive producer Lisa Lyon had Stephen writing for After Dark, and I didn't even know who he was. But then as I began to do more programs and read more of the things that he was doing during my part-time days, I realized what a great astronomer he is. So we're proud to have him as part of the team. In a moment, the death of money. Jim Rickards back on Coast to Coast. Get ready for 2 hours of a riveting interview. He's next with me on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, get ready, get a pad and pencil ready or a pen. Jim Rickards is the chief global strategist at the West Shore Funds and director of the James Rickards Project, which is an inquiry into the complex dynamics of geopolitics and global capitalism. He is a portfolio manager, a lawyer, an economist. He was on with me back in April as we talk about his work, The Death of Money, the coming collapse of the international monetary system. Jim, welcome back. First of all, I've got so much to talk with you about. Absolutely looking forward to this. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and you ready for the holidays?
I am, George. Looking forward to it. Thank you very much. It's great to be back on the program. Yeah, I am looking forward to Christmas and New Year's very much.
I want to get your take, first and foremost, before we even get rolling into the death of money, your take on the plummeting prices of oil. It seems to be good for consumers, but I want your take on, is it really Saudi Arabia trying to put the squeeze to those who are fracking, putting them out of business?
That's basically it, George. This is a very big deal. Of course, I think most listeners realize that the price of oil has come down significantly in recent months, from about $100 a barrel down to around $65 a barrel, a little bit lower. So that's a 35, almost 40% decline. So that's been in the news. But listeners may not realize what a big deal that is. That is the third largest, fastest decline in decades. You have to go back to the 1980s to find something comparable. Now, you're right. It's good news for consumers. You know, we all like paying, you know, $1.99 at the pump instead of $4.05. And if you're using 100 gallons of gas a week, you know, that might put $200 in your pocket. That's a lot of money. So that's the good news. Although it's not obvious that consumers are going to go right out and spend all that money. A lot of people say, oh, you put the money in the consumer's pockets, they'll go spend it. Maybe, but, you know, they might pay down debt or pay down you know, their student loans or their kids' student loans or something. So they might save some of it, might not all get spent. But basically, that's the good news. The bad news is that how did we get all this fracking? How did we get all this oil to create this surplus for these lower prices? Well, the answer is there were trillions of dollars bonds issued and stock issued to do the exploration and the drilling. And when they borrowed that money, when the oil companies, these are small, medium-sized companies by and large, when they borrowed that money, they were assuming oil somewhere between $80 and $150 a barrel, depending on the project. When you put oil at $60 a barrel, a lot of that debt's not going to get repaid. So there's a lot of bad debt out there. This reminds me a little bit of the, you know, the whole subprime mortgage collapse that happened in 2007, 2008. Very few people saw it coming. You know, the central bank, you know, Ben Bernanke at the time did not see it coming. I'm not sure people see this one coming either, but there could be $1 trillion or more of stock and bond losses in the over the next year or so coming out of this collapse of oil prices.
James, I just had a story that 30% of the shoppers in Britain are buying their things, their goods, online now, and I got to believe that that percent is probably the same here in the United States and Canada. I think that's amazing. If that number holds up, 30% of the people merely sitting at home or with their smartphones ordering away using their credit cards because they just don't want to spend the time going to these bricks and mortar stores anymore. That's big, isn't it?
Well, it's a very big deal, and it also kind of goes to the last point. If you're shopping at home, what are you not doing? Well, you're not getting in your car and driving to the store and using up gasoline. So this is part of this whole supply-demand equation. We have a lot more supply coming from fracking and new drilling technology in places like North Dakota and Texas and Pennsylvania and elsewhere. We have a lot less demand, not just in this country because of online shopping, but all around the world. I mean, the Chinese economy is slowing down. The Japanese economy hit the wall this year. Europe is slowing down. So, you know, this is economics 101. You have more supply, less demand. You're going to get lower prices. So that's inevitable. But a lot of this is being engineered by Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia, all that infrastructure was built decades ago. They can lift that oil out of the ground for a couple dollars a barrel. They're not like the guys in North Dakota paying, you know, $70 a barrel. They're paying, you know, $3 or $4 a barrel. So they can still pump oil very profitably, even at lower prices. Now, they like to make money as much as anybody. So the question is, what is the number? How low could oil prices go? Well, you're hurting the fracking guys. You're making their projects non-economic, but you're still making enough money for yourself. But you got to solve that problem. But the answer is around $60 a barrel. That's about where oil is. So, yeah, the whole online shopping thing, I see it with my book, The Death of Money. I mean, a lot of my sales are Kindles, which is great. I mean, I'm a little old school. I like the hard copy of the book. I might go down to the bookstore and buy them. But people shop on Amazon, and they like the downloads. You're absolutely right.
Well, they sure do. Okay, back to now, The Death of Money 2. That is a scary, scary sounding phrase there. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I talk about the death of money, what I'm really talking about is the collapse of confidence in the U.S. dollar and by extension all the major currencies around the world. And it sounds extreme, but it really isn't. You go back over recent history, let's say the last 100 years, the international monetary system actually has collapsed 3 times in the past 100 years, 1914, again in 1939, and again in 1971, when Richard Nixon took the U.S. dollar off the gold standard, said that dollars can no longer be converted to gold at a fixed price. Now, the important thing is when this happens, so this seems to happen every 30 or 40 years. It's been 40 years since the last time. That doesn't mean the system's going to collapse tomorrow, but nobody should be surprised if it does. You can sort of see this coming. Having said that, it doesn't mean the end of the world. It doesn't mean we all go live in caves with, you know, eat canned goods and all that. What it does mean is that the major trading and financial powers sit down around the table and they rewrite what they call the rules of the game. And the rules of the game is not my phrase. That's actually a very old phrase that the power elites use to describe how the international monetary system works. So you have to come up with new rules of the game. So what I'm trying to do is, first of all, understand the dynamics of the collapse. Understand how this collapse is coming so you can see it coming and kind of warn investors. But beyond that, figure out what the new rules of the game are going to be and then come back to square one and say, what can you do today as an investor or a saver, maybe someone relying on pension or insurance or retirement income to preserve your wealth in this new world that's coming? You can see it coming. And you just want to see, well, what is that going to consist of? How will that play out? What does it mean for me today as someone who's, you know, trying to save or invest or rely on your retirement income?
If you don't play, though, and I don't mean you as an individual, but as a government, the rules of the game, like Saddam Hussein decided not to play, or Gaddafi, look what happens to them.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, Gaddafi gave up his weapons of mass destruction. He had a nuclear program on a small scale, and he surrendered it to the CIA. You know, flew over there, and they collected all his material and his weapons. He wanted to be kind of a good citizen, if you will, get back into the good graces of the world. Saddam Hussein, we now know, also gave up his weapons of mass destruction, but they were both killed. I mean, Gaddafi got a bullet in the eye, and Saddam was hanged on the gallows. And you look at the people who did not give up their nuclear programs, North Korea and Iran, those guys are still around. So U.S. policy seems to be sending the wrong message. We're saying, well, if you give up your programs, you get whacked. But if you don't give up your programs, hang on to your nukes, there's not much we can do about you. So that's probably the wrong message. But my question on Libya, Libya had 100 tons of gold. That is a lot of gold. There are only about 35,000 official tons in the world. When I say official, I mean gold that's owned by central banks and sovereign wealth funds and finance ministries, not counting, you know, private gold that we have, you know, jewelry and things like that. It's only about 35,000 tons. So 100 tons is a lot in the scheme of things. That gold disappeared. Now, I expect it's on a NATO base somewhere secured, but Gaddafi's dead and the Libyan government doesn't have it anymore. So there's some interesting, you know, things that go on behind the scenes of these wars and revolutions that we see.
So you're saying that all the gold that Libya had is gone?
Well, we don't know where it is. Perhaps it's on a NATO base somewhere, and perhaps NATO would claim that it's being held in trust for the Libyan people, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that's classified information. We don't know where it is. But it was sort of last seen. I mean, when Gaddafi got out of Tripoli and headed into the desert with his entourage, he took the gold with him. And actually, gold's very heavy. It's kind of hard to lug around with you. But
yeah, put it in your pocket.
A lot, but he's dead. He doesn't have it. And it's certainly not in the Libyan Central Bank because that place is in complete chaos. So without having more specifics, I think it's fair to say that it's in NATO or U.S. custody. And, you know, it could be used for leasing or it could be used for other activities in the gold market. So, watch that space, but that's another kind of unsolved mystery.
Gold has been slapped around a little bit, James, lately, but you have always been, and we have too, a staunch supporter of the uptick in gold. Where do you see it headed?
Well, my kind of intermediate to long-term forecast has not changed. I've got it, you know, well north of $5,000 an ounce, probably more like $7,000 an ounce, maybe even higher. Now, I want to be clear, George, these are not made-up numbers. They're not big numbers I pick out of a hat just to, you know, get a few headlines or whatever.
Yeah.
This is actually where gold would have to be if you have to go back to a gold standard, not because you want to, but because you have to restore confidence. One of the big questions is, well, what should the dollar price of gold be if you're going to have some kind of gold standard? Now, this is just eighth grade math. This is not that complicated. You say, okay, well, how much paper money is there? How much gold is there? You know, divide one by the other, and that'll give you a number. Now, it's a little more difficult than that because money supply, there are technical definitions. There's what they call M0 and M1. These are technical definitions that the Fed use. You have to pick one of those. You also have to ask yourself, how much gold do you need backing the money? You know, a lot of the Austrian economists say, what's got to be 100% because we don't trust the government. Maybe, but, you know, historically, gold standards have been successful with 20 to 40% backing. So I actually do a conservative calculation. I say, well, let's assume we're using M1, and let's assume 40% backing. That number is over $7,000 an ounce. Now, if you were going to use what's called M2, that's a bigger money supply with 100% backing, that number is $45,000 an ounce. Now, I'm not predicting $45,000 gold. I'm just saying that's what the math tells you. Now, a lot of people say you can't have a gold standard because there's not enough gold. That's nonsense. There's always enough gold. It's just a question of price. Now, if you try to do it at today's price, which is around $1,200 an ounce, then it's true. You'd have to shrink the money supply in order to back it up at $1,200 an ounce. That would be highly deflationary. That would cause a depression worse than the Great Depression. So they're not going to do that. So what's the alternative? If you're not going to shrink the money supply, you have to increase the dollar price of gold. Then whatever quantity of gold you have, it works fine at the higher price. So I've got a $7,000 now. So having said that, sure, it was 1900 in August of 2011. It's come down significantly from there, but it's still 600% increase from where it was.
Oh, that's huge. Jim, hold on with us. We're going to come right back after this break as we talk about the death of money. I'm George Norrie, and yes, you're listening to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Jim Rickards, The Death of Money. Jim, back to gold for a little bit. Aren't some countries now asking for their stored gold supplies to be returned back to their native countries?
Well, that's right, George. There are two big movements going on in the gold world. One is just countries buying gold, adding to the gold reserves. We can talk about that in a minute if you like. That's mainly China, Russia. But there are a lot of countries, they're not necessarily buying more gold, but over the decades, they have stored their gold mostly in New York, at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You know, a lot of people think that Fort Knox is the biggest gold depository in the world, but it isn't. The U.S. has about 8,000 tons. We keep half our gold at Fort Knox, about 4,000 tons, and we keep the other half of our gold at West Point, which is another military base, about 4,000 tons there. But the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has 6,000 tons. That's the biggest single depository in the world. That gold does not belong to the United States. It belongs to countries all over the world, Germany, France, Netherlands, you know, Japan, UK, the IMF, et cetera. Now, what's been happening lately is countries are starting to say, wait a second, the U.S. could get in trouble. The U.S. could have a financial collapse. The United States is very good at seizing assets. We've been seizing other people's assets for a century or more. Just ask the Iranians and the North Koreans and the Syrians, a lot of other people about that. And now the Russians are in the line of fire. So they're saying, well, I want to get my gold back in my country to keep the U.S. from taking it. So Germany asked for their gold about a year and a half ago. That has been moving very slowly. They got a little bit, not as much as they wanted. That is, as I say, proceeding very slowly. Netherlands got their gold back very recently. There was a referendum in Switzerland. It did not pass, but it would have required Switzerland to bring their gold back to Zurich. And now it's being raised as a political issue in France, a political issue in Belgium. The first guy to do it actually was Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Of course, he's dead now, but when he was gone, president or dictator of Venezuela, he got his gold back. His gold was not in New York. It was in London. That's the Bank of England's the other big depository. So you're seeing countries all over the world get their gold back. Now, a lot of people say, well, so what? You know, you take it out of one vault, you stick it in another vault, the total supply is unchanged. Who cares? But there's more to it than that, because when the gold is in New York or London, it can be used for leasing. It can be leased out to the banks, and then those banks can sell 10 times as much gold. So if the Federal Reserve leases, let's say, 10 tons to J.P. Morgan, J.P. Morgan can then sell 100 tons of paper gold, and that's one of the ways they manipulate the price. Now, let's say you take that 10 tons and you move it to the Netherlands or Germany. Well, it's the same amount of gold, but it's not available for leasing. There are no leasing markets, no well-developed leasing markets in those countries. So you're not changing the total supply, but you're reducing what's called the floating supply, which is the amount available for leasing. So this makes the whole leasing manipulation market more unstable. So it's a very big deal, and at some point, you're going to start to see what's the equivalent of a run on the bank, which is exactly what happened to the United States in 1971. That was a run on Fort Knox when France and Spain and Switzerland and other countries were saying to the United States, give me my gold back, and that gold was coming out of Fort Knox. But now you might see a run on the Federal Reserve Bank of New York where people want their gold back for storage. That's going to destabilize the gold market and gold manipulation because they need that gold to do these paper transactions that they use to suppress the price. So it's a very big deal and does seem to be gathering momentum.
James, for the person who, and we're going to talk about the person who's not working in a moment, but for the person who's working as a mortgage, a couple cars, he or she taking care of their families, what do you see as the most pressing issue for them financially in 2015, right around the corner?
Well, the biggest threat to kind of everyday Americans, kind of working and trying to pay their bills and put their kids through college or save for retirement is inflation. Now, we don't have very much inflation right now. That's true. In fact, actually, deflation seems to have the upper hand where prices are going down. But you have to look at it from the Federal Reserve's point of view, from the point of view of our central bank. they want inflation. They said so. This isn't, you know, kind of a crystal ball. I mean, Janet Yellen, chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, has said many times they have a 2% inflation target. I've spoken to regional reserve bank presidents who have told me privately, they won't say this publicly, but privately they say they wouldn't mind seeing 3, even 3.5% inflation. So the Fed has a target of, let's just say, 2 to 3%. Actual inflation is around zero, maybe even going negative. So what's the Fed going to do about that? Well, they've got to somehow create the inflation, and the way they do that, of course, is by printing money. If you print the money long enough, eventually you'll get there. Eventually you'll get the inflation. And that destroys the real value of the dollar. So who loses in that? If you have an insurance policy, an annuity, money in the bank, retirement savings, any kind of fixed income, you're the one who loses in a situation like that, because you still get your dollars. You get the same number of dollars, you know, in the mail every month, or, you know, by direct deposit. But it's worthless. It doesn't go as far once the inflation takes off. So that's the thing I would watch out for. By the way, if someone is kind of like an average income and has some debt, a lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, people complain, gee, I put my money in the bank and I get, you know, nothing, basically, you know, a quarter of 1%. But let's say you have some debt out there, whether it's credit card debt, or, you know, maybe your credit card debt is 10% or 15%. Well, if you pay down that debt, that's exactly the same as investing in something that pays you 15%, because now you don't have to pay the interest. So paying down debt is the same thing as investing in something that pays you whatever the credit card company is charging you, or the loan company, or whatever. So that's usually a very smart strategy. A lot of times your best investment is to pay down that high interest debt, and that'll put the most income in your pocket.
That's a good point. Absolutely. Okay, now what about the person who is unemployed, James? What do they have to look forward to next year?
Well, unfortunately, that's a very, very difficult situation. We are not creating the jobs that we need. Now, you know, last Friday we had an employment report, and it said the U.S. created 321,000 jobs approximately, and everyone was, oh, happy days are here again, and, you know, the stock market was going to boom and all that. Well, look, it is good news. It's great to create those jobs, but let's look behind the numbers a little bit. We are not creating the full-time jobs we need. We are creating part-time jobs. In fact, we're losing a lot of full-time jobs and substituting part-time jobs. Now, just look at how that plays out. So let's say you make $25 an hour and you work 40 hours a week. Well, that's $1,000 a week. Over the course of the year, that's a $50,000 job.
Before tax, of course.
Before tax, that's correct, before taxes. So just call that a $50,000 job approximately. Now, let's say they'll get a part-time job where it's 20 hours a week at $10 an hour. That's $200 a week, or $10,000 a year. So what's happening is we're losing the $50,000 jobs. We're getting a lot of the $10,000 jobs. There's dignity in all work. I mean, anyone who's out there working, God bless them. But you can't run an economy. You can't generate the kind of growth we need if you're losing the $50,000 jobs and replacing them with $10,000 jobs.
No.
Now, when these employment reports come out from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they don't make the distinction. I mean, you can find it buried in the footnotes. But they just say we created jobs. But a lot of people don't look past the headline numbers and say, well, okay, but what kind of jobs are we creating? What kind of salaries do they pay? What's happening to real wages? Those statistics do not look nearly as strong. There's another statistic that's very important. It's called labor force participation. And what this is the simplest number of all, and to me it's the one that is the most important. It says forget about, you know, part-time, full-time, seeking more work, voluntarily, involuntarily. Those are all the distinctions that the statisticians use. But labor force participation is just how many people are capable of work and how many are actually working. Just divide one by the other. It's as simple as that. That number is at the lowest it has ever been, within, you know, 0.1%. It's the lowest in 40 years. It's the lowest since, you know, women started entering the workforce. So it's basically saying that more and more people are home. They're out of the workforce. They're not even technically unemployed because they're not looking for work. They might be helping out around the house, or, you know, maybe on the couch watching basketball games, but they're not working. An economy is nothing more than how many people are working and how productive are they. I mean, you can get fancy with the definitions, but at the end of the day, it's that simple. How many people are working, how productive are they? And what the numbers tell us is that fewer people are working as a percentage of the population than any time since the Jimmy Carter administration. So that's what's holding the economy back. So, you know, I do, my children are in their late 20s and early 30s, and I talk to them and a lot of their friends, and I do a lot of counseling of folks in that age group. And what I say to some of them is, I say, look, you know, it's great if you can get a job, but if you can't, invent your own job. You know, be an entrepreneur, start a company. It's easier said than done. There's a lot of risk in it. But a lot of times, you know, the way to kind of get gainfully employed is actually start your own business somehow. It could be anywhere from a, you know, a food truck to a social digital media consultant, or you have some invention or something you can do. But don't wait around for a job. Go invent your own job. And sometimes that's the solution.
Would you go to college today if you could afford it?
Well, I would go to college, but I wouldn't have any illusions about the fact that that's a ticket to the job market. Now, some programs are. Look, if you're going to be a computer science major, a computer engineer, and you stick to it and you're good at math and programming, you're going to get a job in a heartbeat. And the statistics for unemployment among college graduates are much healthier than non-college graduates. So there's a lot to be said for college. But to me, the reason to go to college, it's not so much that it's a ticket to a job, but you get an education. I think that, you know, just the familiarity with philosophy, history, literature, science, the ability to think critically and see through some of the propaganda we're getting from, whether it's the government or the media or other channels. To me, that's the value of college, is not so much the job prospects, but just the education, being able to be a better citizen.
In your opinion, Jim, if you could fix one thing right now about the economy, what would it be?
Well, it wouldn't have anything to do with money supply, I can tell you that, because that's not going to solve anything. I would cut taxes. I mean, I would just trust the American people to figure out the best way to spend the money. I know they can do it better than the government, and I would just cut taxes.
Yep.
It worked for Ronald Reagan. It'll work again.
Are there any plans to cut taxes? Realistically, cut them.
Well, I think that might be one of the surprises in 2015. Now, look, the White House is against it, and we do have budget deficits we have to deal with, and you can't be glib about it. But remember, 2016, of course, is an election year, and politicians love to cut taxes. You know what's been happening in the last 5 years, George, is that Federal Reserve has been printing money. It hasn't worked. Maybe it prevented a more severe downturn in 2009. Maybe that kind of that QE1 performed a useful role, but QE2 and QE3 have done nothing for the economy. All they've done is created asset bubbles in the stock market and the housing market, which are going to burst. That's a separate problem.
They've pushed and prolonged, I think, the inevitable.
Well, that's right, but they did so at a cost. Yeah, they pushed off some of the adjustment. That's what we're talking about. When you talk about tax cuts and things like that, those are structural adjustments. Those are the things we need to do to get the economy moving. And it's not just tax cuts. It's Keystone Pipeline, environmental regulation, labor mobility. There are just a whole long list of things, but they're not things that the Federal Reserve can do. These are things that the Congress and the White House have to do. Well, unfortunately, the Congress and the White House are barely talking to each other, so I don't hold out much prospect for that. But getting back to the Federal Reserve, you know, just printing money and giving it to the banks isn't doing any good. The banks are just sitting on the money. People don't want to borrow. The banks don't want to lend. They're just piling up reserves in their accounts at the Feds. At the Fed. So they need something called helicopter money. Helicopter money is the idea was, well, we don't have to worry about people spending. We'll just print money and push it out of helicopters, and they'll take it and spend it. But the problem is the banks are standing in the way. So what you need to do is take the banks out of the equation. Don't rely on the banks to lend the money. Just give money directly to people. Well, how do you do that? Well, tax cuts, you know, particularly the payroll tax, because less than half the Americans pay income tax, believe it or not, but almost every working person pays the payroll tax. So if you want to put money in people's pockets, cut the payroll tax. Now, that will increase the deficit in the short run, but the Fed is kind of saying to the Treasury, hey, go issue the bonds to cover the deficit. We'll print the money to buy the bonds, so we got your back. Meanwhile, that will put money into people's pockets. And then if you combine that with some other things, like let's build the Keystone Pipeline, let's build natural gas pipelines. So maybe we need to convert diesel trucks to natural gas. That's easy technology. That's not putting a man on Mars or a woman on Mars. That's just very straightforward stuff. So that's the kind of thing that could get America moving again. But, you know, people don't trust the White House, because the last time we had a stimulus bill and we spent $800 billion in 2009, a lot of that money was wasted. It went to prop up, you know, government sector jobs. It did not go to infrastructure, as was promised. But so people don't really trust the White House on that. But if we could have an infrastructure bill, a tax cut, Keystone Pipeline, a few other smart things, I'd be a lot more bullish on the economy. Unfortunately, I don't see any of those things, at least in the short run.
The death of money, the coming collapse of the international money system. Now, when you talk about the collapse of the international money system, explain that for us, James.
Well, right now, the keystone of the international monetary system is the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is the number one reserve currency. And just to explain quickly what a reserve currency is, you know, if you make $50,000 and you spend $40,000 and you have $10,000 left over, those are your savings. You can put it in the bank, you can buy some stocks or bonds, you can do a lot of things with it, but that's your surplus. Well, it's no different with countries. When countries export more than they import, they have some savings, and those are called reserves. Well, if you're a country, you have to invest your reserves in something. You can't just stick it under a mattress. So you're just like an individual. You go out and buy stocks and bonds, and the number one reserve currency is the U.S. dollar. 60% of all the reserves of all the countries in the world are invested in U.S. dollars. And that's a big advantage for the United States because it means we can fund our deficits, we can run a trade surplus ourselves, trade deficit ourselves, we can run budget deficits and just print the money, and everyone takes it because they'll take our treasury debt. Now, what's going on in the world today is a couple things are happening. Number one, more and more countries are moving to gold. Russia has doubled its gold reserves in the last 5 years. They've gone from about 600 tons to over 1,100 tons.
Yeah, very smart.
So I think it's very smart. I wish the U.S. would buy some more gold, but we're not. China has increased its gold reserves even more, several 100%. Now,
sure.
Nobody knows the exact number because
India, too, right?
India is increasing it. Mexico, you go around the world, Argentina, believe it or not, Argentina is pretty broke, but they're buying gold. Some smaller countries, Korea, others are adding to the list as well. This is all documented in my book, but China's the big, the big 500-pound gorilla here. They have bought thousands of tons, but they do it through stealth. They lie about how much they have. They say officially they have about 1,000 tons. The actual number is 3,000 or 4,000 tons, and that's not guesswork. We can see the imports. We look at Swiss exports, Hong Kong imports, Chinese mining output. You have to do some technical analysis, but there's enough evidence out there to say that they've got closer to 4,000 tons, and they're still buying it. So I look at that and say, well, one of two things is true. Either the Chinese are stupid, or they see something a lot of people don't. Well, I spent a lot of time in China. They're not stupid. They see something coming that a lot of us don't, and that's why they're buying the gold.
Have we tapped into all the gold resources available out there?
Well, no, there's still gold in the ground, but the thing is, and this has been true for 100 years, it's very expensive to mine. This is why gold is a good form of money, because you can't just print it up. Now, you and I could go out and probably find some gold. I mean, there's gold in Vermont, there's gold all over the place, but it's really tiny, it's really hard to find, it's really expensive. So you can find more gold, but the question is, what are the costs of production? Now, right now, with gold at about $1,200 an ounce, the cost of production in many mines is higher than the market price. So what that means is mines are closing down, new projects are not getting started, the gold supply is starting to shrink. It doesn't mean there's no more gold in the ground. It does mean that it's not profitable to dig it up. And so that's going to actually give some strength to the gold price because that's going to reduce the supply. Meanwhile, we already talked about the demand coming from China and Russia and elsewhere around the world. So when demand is strong and supply is shrinking, you get a higher price. Now, against that, you have to put the fact that there's a lot of manipulation in the gold market. And again, this is not conspiracy theory stuff. This has been documented. There are lawsuits. There are enforcement actions. The manipulation is there, but it still goes on. And a lot of times, the reason it's not enforced or the law is not enforced is because the people doing the manipulation are countries. You know, nobody at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is going to start an investigation of China. That's not going to happen. If you're some little speculator committing fraud in the market, they'll come get you, but they're not going to go after a player like China.
No. Jim, stay with us. We're going to take this break here in a moment. We're going to come back and take your phone calls with Jim Rickards as we talk about the death of money. If you're working, check in with us. If you're not, love to hear your story, too. We'll be back.